It changes fundamentally the quality of your life. If you are being responsive instead of reactive, there's a ripple effect. And so what things that would normally escalate, de-escalate. And so you have less of those outbursts. You have less of those bad behaviors or bad situations because you can't control other people. You can control yourself, and that influences other people, usually for the positive.
Welcome to Humble Mind, a social learning community with an insatiable curiosity for new ideas and connecting with like minds in life and business. This podcast is where we get to speak with other unusual humble minds. And if you're a member of our community, you get to join our recording live. Like today, we've got Helene, John, Rana, and Manette with us. You also get access to early releases of new clips on our platform, our weekly newsletter, content replays from previous sessions, as well as our invitation to join our Thursday Thrive live group meetup. So check out humblemind.co for more. It's pretty easy to keep physically fit. I suppose billions of people do it every day without thinking, right? You go to the gym, you go to a personal trainer, you play a sport, you do yoga. But when it comes to keeping mentally fit, we don't really give this nearly as much attention. And this doesn't really make sense when you think about it, because how can we not extend the same courtesy to our own minds? Everything lives in your brain, your life, your memories, your emotions, your knowledge, your talent, your ability to reason, your thoughts. And if you're working in a high-pressure job or a team or growing your own business, then this balance can become even more off-center. There doesn't seem to be a rule book on how to think about your mental fitness. Or is there? Well, today we're speaking with Jody Rogers, who is an expert coach, a facilitator, founder of Symbia Partners, and they've made a name for themselves working with the likes of Google, Barclays, L'Oreal, Unilever, Kellogg's, Meta, you name it, and quite a few others in the subject of improving your mental fitness, how that helps to influence behavior, and ultimately how that shows up in the results of senior leaders and teams across the world. So welcome, Jody. Thanks for joining us today on the podcast and being with our community.
Great. Happy to be here. Looking forward to it.
Lovely. So you were on the podcast when this was in its early days, when this was still called the Humble Pie. Clearly, I've got a fascination about that word, but I've kept out with the pie, kept the mind part in. And we had a great conversation a while ago. So it's really nice to catch up with you. I wanted to ask you and start off in the beginning just to provide some context for everyone else listening, but also because in the while I've known you, I've actually never asked you this, your journey of how you got to running Symbia and running these incredible programs around the world and keeping you a very busy lady indeed, how you got there, because I know you spent about sort of 20 years or so in corporate, and then there must have been a sort of a moment where you decided, okay, I'm going to do my own thing. What was that like, and what was that journey like for you?
Well, that is the killer question, and you might need to pour a beer for this one. Right, let me try and give you the short version. So my background is in psychology and interpersonal communications, and I went into the world of qualitative and quantitative research. So understanding how people think, how they make decisions, and then how they act on those things. I found myself in this space of consumer market insight. So helping companies and brands and businesses understand human behavior in order to know of these three advertising ideas, what's the one that's going to get a behavior change? What's the one that's going to get people to buy our brand instead of someone else's brand? And I worked in that space, agency side, so with supporting lots of different companies and brands, for probably 7 years, and then I worked client side for another 7 years. So working inside big corporates and helping bridge the research back into marketing and into the business in order to make strategic decisions. And then in my early 30s, I had what I call a midlife awakening, where I thought, I thought lots of things, much of which can't be said on a podcast, but I thought, hold on a minute. I am using my understanding of human behavior to help sell stuff to people that they may not want or need and may not be able to afford. Is that really a good use of my skill set? And I knew then that I wanted to do something different. I knew I wanted to work with people rather than at the coalface of brands and marketing, but I didn't know exactly what. And so I quit my job, bought a one-way ticket to Mexico. I was living in Brazil at the time, and took one book, which is actually on my bookshelf here. Let me grab it. The Stephen Covey, our old friend, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, which is a book that you read, but it's a book that reads you, that if you do it properly, it's a proper workbook. It probably took me about 6 months to actually get through it, because I did the work. And I traveled overland backpacking on my own from Mexico back down to Brazil, spent about 5 months doing that. I say on my own, but you're never really alone. You meet like really interesting people along the way, all holding the question, what do I want to do? Like, what do I want to do with my life? What do I want to do? How do I want to show up in the world? And I'd love to say, and the answer was Symbia. Ultimately, that was the answer. But life isn't linear, and it's messy, and it's confusing and complicated. And I had clarity that I wanted to work with people. And I had been, lots of people had said to me, you should have your own business, and you should be a coach, and you should blah, 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 blah. And I had said no to all of that. At the time, my only exposure to coaching was Tony Robbins. And I was like, you know, if you believe, you will receive, and you can all be millionaires, and was not interested in any of that. But at some point, I realized I didn't really actually know what that was. So I made a commitment to find out what it was. And I did a 2-year diploma in executive coaching, and went back to London, and at the same time went back into the corporate world. But I gave myself a 2-year time frame, right? Once you get your certificate, you have to get out of here and go do what you're meant to do. Anyway, I'll shorten the story. I did quit my job. I simultaneously moved to Canada, because I had in that time fallen in love and was doing long distance relationship with a Canadian who's now my husband, who you know, Alex, and thought, right, that's it, close the corporate door, I am all about this now, which is helping people actualize their lives. And the story does not end there, because I quickly realized I don't really love one-on-one coaching. You can get lost in people's stories. And actually, I had shut the door on all of this strategic thinking, business, brand, like all of this expertise. And anyway, slowly, it took me about a year to get there, I realized that there is this Venn diagram, this beautiful overlap between business and what it means to be human. And that's really leadership and professional development, right? So not the what of business, but the how of business. And then at the point, people were still coming to me for insights and research and strategic thinking. And I slowly had to reposition myself into, let me speak with your people. It doesn't matter how brilliant your business model is, how great your innovation funnel is, how much investment you have. If your people don't have the right mindset in order to take the risks they need to take, make the decisions at the right time in the right way, and believe in the goals that you're trying to strive for, if none of that exists, then it's just nice stuff on a piece of paper. And so then I started to work in that space. I began working with purpose, helping leaders uncover their own purpose, began running team offsites and helping people enhance their effectiveness and collaboration and communication, et cetera, et cetera. Fast forward, Symbia has now been around for 10 years. And in the beginning years, it was just me doing my thing. The last kind of 5 years, it's been a team of us where we do two core things. We run, and deliver bespoke leadership workshops, helping groups, teams get from point A to point B, wherever that is for them. And that could be, you know, enhancing productivity, it might be integrating teams, it might be dealing with the consequences of post-restructure, etc. And then we also work with capabilities, so training, and that is on the how of business, so navigating conflict, active listening, mental fitness, which to the topic, this idea of mental and emotional fitness penetrates everything that we do, because Symbia, the name, is born from this the belief that we have that our businesses and the fabric of our businesses are intertwined with our well-being as humans. Because if we aren't showing up in the best way that we can, how can we perform and how can we deliver both in our lives and for our companies? These things are intertwined and they can't be treated differently. Mental and emotional fitness is something that came into sharp focus for me in the pandemic. And of course, because we used to have to Trojan horse this topic into some of the biggest companies in the world. Why? Because, you know, well-being, okay, we'll do it because we have to, we'll tick some boxes, or we'll do it because we want to keep people out of a place of ill health, out of anxiety, burnout, overwhelm, etc. But in the pandemic, suddenly people were listening. They could see the consequences and they realized they needed to help people. And that's when I wrote the book, The Hidden Edge, Why Mental Fitness is the Only Advantage That Matters in Business, which is deliberately provocative because it's there to spark a debate. And so these days we do lots of things, and sometimes we'll go in and it will just be the topic of mental fitness. But 9 out of 10 times, they think we're working on prioritization, which we are, but let's face it, we know how to prioritize. The problem is we just rank order 27 things. We don't know how to say no to things because of fear of failure, and fear of getting it wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, we will work on ways of working, but we also know that there's something deeply human that is helping your team show up in the right way or not helping them show up in the right way. And that's where mental and emotional fitness comes in.
There's so much there that you said, and the different temperaments of how people, react to the state of their own mental fitness, how leaders look at that. Obviously, a lot of the time it's easy for them to just see it as another performance enhancing kind of trick to throw into the mix. Versus the actual long-term well-being of people who are working day in, day out for years and years on important projects. But maybe just to start with the term itself, mental fitness, it's really broad. So is there a useful way that you can define what it means to think about mental fitness as opposed to something like mental well-being or even mindfulness? You know, a lot of people, I think, are aware of kind of basically what these concepts mean, but it's also in that sort of early stage where a lot of people can conflate these things at the same time. So how do you think about mental fitness?
So I want you to imagine a spectrum in your mind, except the spectrum isn't horizontal. The midpoint is flat and horizontal, but to the left it goes down, and to the right, it goes up, right? So a bit of a disjointed chart. I really consider well-being in the center where it's flat, horizontal. And for the sake of argument, let's just say zero on a scale. Ill health, mental and emotional ill health is in the negative, right? It goes right down -3, -5, -10. And mental fitness is in the upper end where it goes +3, +5, +10. Now, why am I painting it like that? Because a lot of time and energy is spent in the well-being space, which is absolutely important. And we need to teach people how to maintain balance and not get held hostage by their thoughts and emotions. And time and energy and funding is spent in the ill health space. Not enough, mind you, not enough. But the goal is generally, how do we keep people either out of it, or when they're in burnout, depression, anxiety, how do we return them to well-being? However, there is not enough energy, time, resource, or money spent on this idea of mental fitness, which is based on the concept, and you drew the parallel, which I always draw between the physical world. It's the absence of illness does not equal health. It's not enough to not be ill. We actually need to put energy into being fit. Now, you might run a marathon once in your life. That does not get you to fitness until you retire. It's a practice. It's ongoing and it is consistent. And so just like you exercise your muscles at the gym, you need to also exercise your neurological pathways in terms of how they are helping or hindering your thought patterns, your decision making, and your emotional responses. And we used to believe that the brain after the age of 12 didn't change, right? It was what it was. We now know, and have known for the last decade, about neuroplasticity. So actually you can continue to rewire and retrain your brain and lay down new neural pathways. And that's important for lots of reasons, which maybe we'll get into later. But the parallel, I'll continue with the metaphor with physical fitness. In the 1970s, it was they finally had the irrefutable evidence where they made the connection between smoking and cancer. Like, they knew it, they had correlationary evidence before, but now it was irrefutable causal evidence. In that moment in Europe and also North America, it caused a paradigm shift in the medical world, where the conversation then went to, well, we have primarily focused on the eradication of disease and illness. However, there are other contributing factors here which are leading to disease and illness, such as maladaptive behavior, poor nutrition, lack of exercise. What if we educated the global populace on how behavior change and learning about these things could benefit all of us? Would that be a good idea? Yeah, damn straight it would be a good idea.
Damn straight.
Yeah. Up popped the fitness industry, right? And what were the benefits of that? There's capitalistic benefits of that, but from a human point of view, it kept millions out of the system. It saved billions, because now people are not having the heart attacks and not getting the cancer and not doing all of these things. And it positively enhanced the lives of millions of people. We have not applied that same thinking to our mental and emotional landscape. Right? We care about our diet and the food that we put into it. Well, we don't all of the time, but it's all there. It doesn't take a brain surgeon to tell you how to eat healthy. More or less, we've been educated through school system and family, etc. We still don't always do it, but that's for other reasons. We don't have that same education when it comes to our inner world. And when you get it, it is when you have slipped down the inevitable slope into mental and emotional ill health, is when finally, here's a tool, here's a therapist, have you tried this? What about CBT? When you have no capacity for learning, because you're in survival mode.
It's too late.
Your brain cannot process new information. So I'm a big advocate for, we don't wait until it's broken. We learn when we have capacity to learn. Actually, when it's not taboo, when there is no judgment, because these topics can be exciting and interesting and engaging. Who doesn't want to know how to hack your own brain? And so we try and make it fun and engaging and interesting so that when you slip down that slope, which you will, everybody will in their lives, just like you get the common cold, you already have the tools, you already have the practices. You don't need to learn because you know them. You just need to engage. You'll always get a long answer from me, Alex.
Yeah, no, love it. No, love it. And it's great to, what I'm taking away from that is, firstly, what you mentioned about, you know, prevention always being better than cure, you know, rather give people the tools so that they can explore and apply it themselves rather than trying to come in too late with too little. But also this idea of kind of grading that whole thing on a curve. So what happens then when you give people the tools, you expose them to the right material, you give them different ways of thinking and frameworks and useful models of, like, you know, of thinking differently about their situation, about their behaviors, about habits that are not good for them, all of those things. What have you seen in the work you've done with leaders and teams, individuals, where there's a moment or some kind of distinction that you can draw between someone who gets it and is going to follow through and someone who's going to go, yeah, sounds great, and then, you know, they're just going to kind of continue doing what they did, you know, all along? Is there something that kind of maybe is a motivation thing? Perhaps it's a self-belief thing? I don't know. Have you been able to find some interesting trends along over the years?
Yeah, so it's the same really with all behavior change. And the truth is, the danger of this topic, and it's a danger of all knowledge, is that I know this mindset. Because there is fundamentally a difference between knowing something and applying something. And I call knowledge that is unused just beautiful wallpaper for the mind. Because I don't care if you know it, until you actually practice it and your life is different because of it, you haven't embedded it, right? And so to answer the question you didn't ask, and then I'll answer the second question, is what's the difference between those engaged and those who don't? And the difference is recognizing that it is a practice, right? It's like, you know, oh, somebody sat and talked to me about how important running is, so now I know how important running is, but, you know, it's still really hard. Okay, what have you done to practice running? Well, I bought some really great shoes and I joined a membership and I've got new gear. Okay, but have you run yet? Have you actually gone out and gone, wow, this is a bit hard. I need to work on my breathing. I probably need to eat just before I run next time. And I realize my best time to run is at 6 o'clock. And here's my personal best. And I'm going to blah, 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 right? It's a practice. Whereas the tricky thing about our inner world is, because you can't see it, it's hard to measure it and it's hard to feel and see. You know, when someone goes for a run and comes back, other people in the world have seen that that has happened. Whereas the other stuff is so internal and so unseen, it's hard to see that it's happening. And so what we try and do, what the book does and what our sessions do, is, yes, sure, the theory, but actually make it appear in the real world and have tools. Tools are ultimately the bridge between understanding and applying. What is the thing that I can write down to take it out of my head, to make it real, so I can see my thinking, and then I can challenge my thinking and I can come to a different assumption? So I, you know, people regularly say, you know, I read your book and, you know, I get it, but I'm really still struggling with this type of thinking. Okay, so what are you doing about it? Well, I'm thinking to myself that I shouldn't think that way. well, has that ever worked
in any other answer.
Way of your life? You know, as I smoke this cigarette, I'm thinking I really shouldn't smoke. That thought isn't enough. You need to put the cigarette out. You need to recognize what is it doing for you? Not the smoking. There's a secondary benefit there. It's, you know, it's habitual. It's replacing something else that you're seeking. You need to get behind that and understand it. So you need to recognize that it is also a life practice. You know, your ability to challenge your thinking, your ability to self-regulate, and there are steps to it. They are learned and they are learnable. But just like if you were trying to drive a car, you don't get to watch somebody drive a car and go, I know how to drive cars now. No, you have to get in behind the steering wheel, you have to make mistakes, you have to adjust, you have to be a little bit afraid, and then you have to get to comfort. So yeah, it's a practice.
I want to zoom in for a moment on what you said about mistakes and making mistakes, because that, for some reason in our culture all over the world, has become sometimes a taboo worse than, you know, murdering somebody, right? Making a mistake is the ultimate psychological kind of admittance to yourself that you're not worthy. You know, these are the stories we tell ourselves. These are the crazy, undeserved things that we hear, that we inherit maybe from our parents, or things that we've read, or, you know, stuff that we've heard and read in the newspapers maybe. And as much as we can intellectualize and go, yeah, but that's ridiculous, somehow we carry those habitual lines of thinking with us, right? Another one is something that I personally struggle with, which is asking for help. You know, I hate asking for help, and I'm normally the first one to offer it. But when it comes time to me to have to admit to myself, damn it, I've made a mistake, I'm really need help with this, it's so hard. Why do you think, maybe just on the mistake making part, or making a mistake, why is there such a taboo on that? Why are we not good at learning how to embrace making mistakes? Because clearly it's par for the course in any type of development. You have to do that. You have to get comfortable with doing that. Why aren't we?
Yeah, great question. And there's a number of angles that I can take this. I'll zone in on mistakes, and then there's something else I want to pick up on what you said about asking for help, which I think is really interesting. So, the fact that we call it mistakes and we call it failure is part of it, right? Language is powerful.
Oh, such a big word.
Yeah, right. There's judgment in those words, right? You got it wrong, did you? Or were you experimental and you got data back? And now you can use that data to try again. So if you're a marksman, let's say you're you are doing archery, right? You go for the target, you don't get it first time, you don't go, oh no, I'm a failure. You take the data, you adjust, there's wind, there's I need to go to the right a bit, and whatever, and you keep going, you keep going, keep going. Okay, every time more data, more data, more data. However, we'll dive into the corporate world for a moment, because this is part of the problem. We hear people say, we need to fail fast, we need the experimental culture, we need more pilots, we need more in market bravery, blah blah blah. But there's a massive paradox at play, because you're getting your end of year review, which is based on your successes, based on the KPIs that you hit, and based on the revenue in market, right? So those things are at odds with each other. Until we change the reward system, what we get complimented on, why would anybody actually fail fast and make mistakes? Because it's already baked in there that you're doing something wrong. And so I don't know who it was, I think it was on another podcast I was listening to, every day the children came home, the father would say, tell me what you failed at today. And if nobody had a failure, he would be really disappointed. And when people said, well, I tried to jump this wall and I fell and I hurt my foot, yay, good job, you tried, and you failed. But he was reframing what failure means, because if you're not, the danger of being afraid to make mistakes is you do not get into the ring of life. You stay on the stands of life, right? And then you've lived a very safe, failure-free life. But has it been a life worth living?
Wow. Let that just ring out for a moment. it's so true. It's easy to also just say, we embrace the mistakes. You know, that also kind of becomes a band-aid for actually really feeling the pain of that mistake, which is the essential part of it, right? It's easy to say, here we celebrate failure, or, you know, another motto like that. But until someone actually does that and goes, it's okay, I'm glad you failed and I'm glad you fucked up, let's move forward, and that's fine, and I'm, you know, and it's okay. I suppose until those are the kinds of things that can be captured in the end of year KPIs, then I suppose there's not going to be that much change on there. Imagine if there was, you know, how many mistakes you made this year as part of an end year report.
Yeah.
As part of your.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you know who's good at it? I'll say scientists. Scientists grow up in a completely different world where they're supposed to have hypotheses and they are not supposed to try and prove themselves right. They're supposed to try and prove themselves wrong. That whole scientific method is bang on. And we do the exact opposite in life and in the business world. So it's not like it's not possible. There are people out there and they're doing it, and they're doing it right. But we've just decided to make everything a little bit harder for ourselves, I think.
I want to quickly just talk about leadership, because a huge part of what you do is working with leaders, helping them to maybe just think clearly about what leadership is and what it means to them. But of course, there's also a huge part of that, if not maybe the biggest part, which is self-leadership, right? Learning to kind of guide yourself through not only an outside environment, but your own internal environment as well. Do you have a sort of a working theory of leadership, of what sort of mentally fit leadership should look like, what kind of behaviors it should exhibit? What's your thinking on that theme?
So yes, and it's greater than leadership. I really feel, this is how I try to live my own life, and it's not easy, but it is simple, but it's not easy, which is the tenements of emotional and social intelligence, right? Where we have four corners: self-awareness, self-regulation, other awareness or empathy, and then your relationships, also known as influence. And so the self-awareness and self-regulation, actually all of those corners are it's what mental and emotional fitness is based on. And this idea of, if there was a bumper sticker for life, and I heard this from someone, and I can't remember who, but it's brilliant. It is, do not trust everything you think. Our thoughts are not facts. Our emotions are not valid. It really pisses me off when I hear, my emotions are valid. They're not. It's an emotional response. It's probably an echo from your past, or it might be the right response, but in the wrong way to the wrong person at the wrong time. It's data. It's all data. We are not our thoughts, and we are not our emotions. So being able to recognize that this whole inner world is happening, it's not necessarily the truth or facts. And being able to step aside of it and look at it and go, is this helpful? Is what I am thinking and is what I am feeling right now an accurate representation of what's unfolding in front of me? Or am I frustrated with this person in front of me because I haven't had my lunch, let's be honest, or I haven't had a vacation in 6 months and I actually am just irritable generally? But that ability to step outside of ourselves and to not react, but to respond, which we know Viktor Frankl, the forefather of logotherapy, All of his work speaks volumes to me. And I think that that's how everybody should lead, not just leadership, but leading our lives. And so in the most simple terms, I think this is a definition of wisdom, where something can happen, and rather than having a reaction to it, we have a response to it. And as Viktor Frankl says, you know, the difference between a reaction and response is time and space. And the skill is to create either time and space and make a choice as to what your response is going to be, not let whatever bubbles up in front inside of you to be the valid thing that you must now put out into the world. Our emotions come in waves. It's around 90 seconds. If we can withstand disappointment, anger, frustration, even joy, happiness, all of those things for 90 seconds, we can recenter. Our prefrontal cortex comes back online and we can make a wiser choice as to how we show up in the world. The people that are best in this in my life are Gandalf, Yoda, and Dumbledore, right? How do we channel more of these great people where we are not just being a ping pong ball in a machine in our lives, but we are intentional, we are thoughtful, and we are choiceful about how we show up in our world.
Do you think some of that requires a thick skin? And the reason I say that is because in order to do that and to kind of be able to channel that wise kind of internal sort of metronome inside of you, you've got to be able to be resilient to outside forces of pressure and all these things that you've got to do, and you've got to do that, and the stress and so on. But is there something to be said about being able to sort of have a filter of some kind where I'm not going to let this kind of get to me, or yeah, I'm going to deal with that, but just not now. And you're going to just have to be okay with that until I'm ready to make a decision.
Mm-hmm. This is, rather than resilience or thick skin, but I do think that is a part of it. I think it is. So I was saying to Theo, my 8-year-old, last night, I was telling him the secret to life, as I believe it to be.
tell us.
What is it? I think the secret to life is perspective and recognizing that you, at any point in your day, in your life, can just zoom up and get in the helicopter. Get in the helicopter and observe what is happening here. What's in front of me? What's behind me? What are the echoes from the past? Why might this be happening? Again, it's a practice, right? Often it takes ninja skills to do it in the moment, but it can be done. It's often best done post-mortem, but having paused and not reacted and then returned, we're always grateful that we didn't send that email that we were typing with steam coming off the keyboard, right? Because our amygdala is in control and our amygdala is in survival mode and will not take any prisoners. So I think getting the most important skill is being able to get in the helicopter and being able to see things from all perspectives and then make a decision based on the bigger picture of what is going on, not based on your subjective worldview, which is influenced by your experiences, by your past, by your fears, by your hopes, by your doubts, by your physiology, if you're tired, if you're hungry, et cetera, et cetera. And so thick skin is a part of it, but it's awareness. Just don't take everything for face value. The thing in front of you is never the thing that matters. It's the thing behind the thing in front of you that you need to better understand. But most of us are operating our lives here. And so it takes, if you can just practice, Brené Brown talks about being on the dance floor or being on the balcony. I talk about being in the trenches where you're living your life and operational and tactical versus being in the helicopter. And so the skill is twofold. It's first knowing where you are. Am I in the trenches right now, or am I in the helicopter? Right? Because sometimes you haven't asked yourself. You don't know. The second is threefold. The second is knowing where you need to be. Right? I'm in the trenches, and I need to be in the trenches. Right? I need to be in the detail of this, and I need to blah blah blah. I'm in the trenches, and I should be in the helicopter. And then the practice is, how do you get out of the trenches into the helicopter? And again, it's distance and space. It's distance and space. This is why people talk about, you know, the power of journaling, the power of planning your day before turning on your computer and your email, the power of meditation. All of those things, all they're trying to do is distance and space, so that you're not in your life, but you're above your life, and you're making decisions based on that unique perspective that you can do at any moment. I can do it right now, but it takes practice, and people aren't really thinking about that because we're too busy just living our lives.
So well said. It's similar to what Rana has just dropped into the chat now, in a way, being about reflection, the ability to reflect. I suppose it's sort of another way of thinking about perspective, right? To be able to sort of hold it away from yourself and see, that's how I am, or that's how these circumstances really are, independent of how I might feel when I'm in them, you know, when I'm inside the trench and I'm kind of battling with all the emotions, all of the other things that are really not helpful and not helping.
Yeah, absolutely. And to Raina's point, absolutely, reflection. I think reflection is the gateway. Why? Because you can practice it looking at what's just happened. The ninja skill has been able to do it in the moment, which is really hard, but definitely possible. And when you think of Gandalf, you think yourself in an argument, right? You can feel the adrenaline, you can feel the cortisol, the words are in you want to get it out, and not doing that, that's the ninja skill. Not doing that, knowing that you will regret it a lot, just knowing it's data, just because I feel this way doesn't mean I have to react in my primal way. I get to make a choice here. And so being able to do that in the moment, I think, is where all wisdom and where really, truly great leadership lies.
I love the concept of emotions as data. Because I think most of the time people might think of those as complete opposites, right? It's not data, it's what I feel, it's qualitative, it's the experience, right? But I suppose in the context in which you mean it is that it's observable, right? And just like all data is observable. And no matter how angry I might feel, or pissed off at somebody, or jealous I might feel, or whatever the emotion is, there is the option available to me to be able to stand away from it, maybe in 5 minutes after I've had a drink of water and a breath, to sort of just look at that situation and go, okay. I can choose to stay in it, but I can also choose to just observe it and look at it as if it was data, which I think is part of that practice, part of that mental fitness practice, which is so, so, so useful. You've got an interesting remark there from John about how mental fitness might be sometimes characterized or perceived as with a negative undertone in business. I suppose when you're speaking about these kinds of things at this level, you know, we're speaking about self-leadership, about emotions, I'm sure sometimes there's a few people in the room who might not be believers, right? Is there how have you dealt with the heathens among us carrying those negative undertones?
I think when you are trying to advocate for anything or convince anybody of anything, you really should always be speaking to your wildest skeptics. And so we could spend time on trying to convince people that this matters, or we could meet them where they are, in what matters to them. And in business, what matters is bottom line, right? ROI, revenue, margin, productivity, retention, all of those things. And so that's why the first 40 pages of the book, and if you're not into business, I recommend you skip the first 40 pages, is speaking to that value set. So I've spent time and energy in creating a whole business case behind this. Not why we don't do things because they're a good idea or because they're the right thing to do. If we did, there would be no world hunger. We wouldn't have climate change. We wouldn't have, and everybody would be nice and healthy and fit. That's not why we do things. We move towards pleasure. We move away from pain. We're much more likely to move away from pain than we are towards pleasure. And so the business case seeks to not explain why this is a good thing to do because we're good people, but what is the positive, not only the loss of productivity, what happens when people go out on the sick, when motivation goes down, when we have people that stay but don't do the work, right? So that's the cost of mental ill health unaddressed in the business, and not just mental ill health, but like well-being, right? People beneath power. But what is the benefit of actual mental and emotional fitness? What does that do to your bottom line? What does it do to retention? What does it do to productivity, motivation, engagement, and all the things that people measure? And so there's a very powerful business case which shows literally how it enhances the bottom line. And so, yes, there's always skeptics. The danger in any negotiation or any discussion is to tackle things from your worldview when you need to tackle things from their worldview and what matters to them.
That's solid business advice there. That's so true. Maybe just taking this one step further on behalf of what John said is, you know, if you look at the business case, like you just mentioned, and look at the results that that you, as part of Symbia, have been able to garner over the last couple of years, with dramatically improving not just how people feel about their jobs, about themselves, but really making that bottom line actually count. You know, really making an impact there. It shouldn't be a surprise then, right? It shouldn't be something that is that you have to kind of fight for, right? Maybe, you know, now the tide is turning, you're getting more and more leaders who are a lot more partial to this kind of thing, but it says something, doesn't it, about the fact that you've got skeptics in the room who are going to maybe be immediately opposed in some way to this kind of conversation. Don't you find that weird? Because shouldn't it just be like, well, of course the well-being of our people, of course it matters. It, you know, it goes back to what Richard Branson said, right? You know, it's always about have happy people and they'll make happy customers. It's not a difficult thing to understand, yet there's a resistance somehow to that. Where is that? Is that an inherited culture thing, do you think? Is that maybe something that comes with the generational leadership where it's all about buck up, pull your socks up, let's just get this done? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's lots of different layers to it. I think in some cases, it is the attitude of, I never had this and I just got my head down and I did 90 hours a week, blah, 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 which is their value set and their experience and their beliefs. There is also, it's been kind of decompartmentalized or actually just decentralized, and it's like we've got strategy, we've got our ambitions, we've got all these things, and then on the side we have our well-being initiative.
Yes. So
it needs to be systemic, it needs to be integrated in how we show up. It does feel like a no-brainer, but at the same time, if you think at an individual level, we know that we should eat well and we should exercise and that we should have breaks and we should go out into nature and all of those things. It's that full circle, right? Knowledge, beautiful wallpaper for the mind if it's not applied. So it's not really enough to know it, and that's not enough to create behavior change. And I can't help, I'll speak at the individual level for a second and then go back to the company level. I can't help but think, certainly as a business owner and also as a mother, there's something deep down You touched on it earlier on. You didn't say the words, but it came around helpfulness, actually, this idea of limiting beliefs, right? Beliefs that we hold, that we don't always know that we hold, that are rules that we've made up for ourselves about our lives, about our capabilities, about future, etc. And thinking about personal well-being, often we don't do it. There'll be lots of rationale reasons, but underneath, we don't believe we deserve it. We don't believe we're good enough. We need to prove to other people that we are worthy by working very hard. And that if we go for that walk or do the yoga or take 2 weeks off, we're showing the world that we're lazy, for example, right? I'm making this up, but that could be somebody's script. So there's also stuff happening at an individual level where even though we know these things are important, we don't do them because we are striving to break free or to prove something else. Like, I'm worthy of that promotion because I work 80 hours a week. That becomes the thing that's important and also the thing that's valued and rewarded in our workplaces. And so in the workplace, I think it feels like, but if, you know, the amount of times in the last 4 years we get emails from people asking for a resilience workshop, like that doesn't exist. Resilience is an outcome. It's not a thing that you do to people, yeah. But that's part of the problem, right? It's the band-aid. Okay, we're going to put fruit in the canteen. It will be free. And here is your 90-minute resilience workshop. But we need to work deeper at the fabric of who people are and what they believe is allowed for them. And the reframing really helps, right? Let's talk helpfulness for a second, right? I don't want to ask people for help, right? There'd be limiting beliefs underneath that. I, interestingly, am completely different because the way I think about it is not, I don't want to ask people for help because I'm making this up, right? It means that I have failed or I'm not good enough or that I need help or people should pity me or I don't know. I ask people for help because I think it's smart. What is the fastest way to get this done? Who is the best person that can, you know, I don't have to now distill, go and learn something because they've already learned it. So I actually think it's quite clever to get the right people lined up to help us, right? But that's just a reframe. You'll have another belief behind that. And those beliefs will either fuel you to do things or stop you from doing things. So anyway, we need to work at the individual belief systems and also corporate belief systems. Mm-hmm. What do we as a company believe about well-being? We believe it's a waste of time and a waste of money. Okay, well, that's problematic. What's driving that belief? And like I say, we need to look at the whole system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose just going back to what you said about COVID being, you know, in many ways an accelerator for your business and these kinds of conversations is because, you know, we all needed to work from home, or now at least work from home, and remote working is so normalized, even if people are still going to work in the office. You know, most people at least get a day or two a week, or, you know, if not more, at home. And so there's this blurring and blending of work and life, which means that you're going to get a little bit of work that comes into life, and you're going to get a little bit of life that spills over into work. And so these kinds of things are just going to bubble up, right? It's going to come up, and then you've got to be able to have those tools to not so much delineate between the two, but rather just manage it, because otherwise it just becomes one enormous personal professional mess.
Yeah.
Right? The lack of that fitness. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah, totally.
And the perfect example of this, I think, is social media. Why? Because social media, like those moments of pause and transition that we used to have in our lives. Like, I remember living in London for more than a decade, and there was never any internet in the underground. And I think the worst thing they ever did was have Wi-Fi in the underground, which was introduced a few years ago, because those liminal spaces where you got to think and accidentally, even without trying, got into the helicopter of your life, disappeared. Mm-hmm. And now we find ourselves going to the toilet, making a cup of coffee, and any of that free space that we had to go within or to go above has now been sucked into Instagram, which just feeds us a load of shit, which is back to, we care about our physical diet, but are we paying attention to our mental diet? Exposure to these things, the things that you read, the things that you listen to, they have a massive impact on how you think, how you make decisions, the quality of your sleep, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not spending enough attention. So yeah, you're absolutely right. Our professional and our personal lives have interlinked, and it's technology, actually. Technology is a blessing and a curse, and we are still trying to work out how to navigate that, and it becomes even more confounded with AI, but that's a whole other podcast.
Oh, I've got to get you back on for that. Yeah, exactly. The mental wellness conversation in the age of AI. Yeah. I've got one more kind of just a question or topic I want to chat about, but I want to just briefly check in with John, Manette, if you guys have got, you know, any thoughts or anything you want to kind of come off mute for, just while we have you on, any insights or quick questions you might want to throw in. Hey, there we go. There's John. Hey, John.
Hi,
John.
Hi, Jody. Yeah, Jody, I'm a big believer in the mental fitness piece, and I kind of feel like we're on a point in time. I think you said it well, you know, in the 70s with the explosion in physical fitness. And now we've got this point where there's this explosion of mental fitness. There are two things joining together. And do you feel that, you know, we're actually at that, you know, that point where mental fitness is going to go almost like mainstream, as physical fitness did? I suppose that's my question.
I would love it to. I would absolutely love it to. There's weak signals that it's going in that direction. But from what I've seen from an investment perspective, we saw the pendulum swing the total other way in 2022, with a lot of budget from learning and development and well-being teams being taken away, and from those teams actually being downsized, and the focus being on restructuring and cost saving, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's from the corporate perspective. Then from the individual perspective, it's a good question. I think we're more literate in that we know what well-being is, and some people are okay to talk about the fact that they meditate. Not quite there, certainly in Europe, when it comes to the therapies, you know, in the Americas, particularly South America, you will happily say, I can't do that because I've got a dentist appointment. They will happily say that about a therapy appointment, whereas here it's still very much taboo. And we're getting better at it, but it's this sense that something has broken and you have failed. But, you know, if we'll look back to the earlier conversation, I've seen an amazing initiative called, what's it called? Self-something. By a guy called Chance, it's escaping me, I'll find it, where they've done something that I actually had a dream to do, and they've done it, and even better because now I don't have to, where they now have pop-in therapeutic spaces in the high street. So there, I think there's like 8 of them throughout the UK. Chance Marshall, who is the founder of Self Space, where without any type of appointment,
that's cool,
you can just call in, and they have all different types of, they've got coaches, and they've got I think physiotherapists, they've got psychoanalysts, they've got everybody, and you can just go in and have a cup of tea. You don't even need to speak to anyone, just if you're having a bad day. So the more that this becomes the norm, the more, like, you know, we have McDonald's all over the place, the more that we can go in and do some mental and emotional triage, the better the world will be. I don't think that we're there yet. I think it's going to be, unfortunately, I still think it's going to be some time. The more we talk about it, and particularly with men, don't get this same, you know, this is a whole other podcast, but it's not encouraged. You're encouraged to be strong. You're encouraged to, you know, you don't talk about your feelings. What are you, you loser?
What feelings?
You don't have that community where you can just break down. Like, you really have to be on the edge. And it's like a monumental event to say that anything internal is happening, whereas women, we'll talk about it all the time. And so I worry about the men of the world, in that we don't have the space and the safety for you to not be okay. And it's absolutely okay to not be okay. It's the same as thinking that we're going to get through 70, 80 years of life and never having to go to the doctor. Like, you're not infallible, you know? So, yeah, I hope, John, I hope we're getting closer. There are weak signals. I think we're a good few decades away yet, though.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with the, you know, the men thing. It's quite common that I will come into, you know, a test run coaching session and, you know, you touch all of the right, you know, buttons, shall we say, and that, you know, and then it's like, no, I'm okay now, I can go. And it's like, no, that's not the way it's really going to work. Yeah. But yeah, overcoming that barrier. But I do sense there is, you know, an awareness now. Like, in, for me, it was the 80s. The 80s. And, you know, I read a quote from Bill Rogers, the old marathon champion, saying, fitness is not, you know, a phase, it's a way of life. And I think that's the same now with, you know, mental fitness. I think more and more, you know, so as we've got the younger generations coming through, you know, as you work with younger people, I think they're much, much more aware. We've got to keep this, as in the mind, toned as much as the body. So I think there's hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely hope. Yeah.
I wanted to sort of just, in a way, challenge what we're thinking about right now, in that just specifically when you mentioned you know, how younger people are definitely more aware and more conscious of these kinds of questions, which is definitely true, John. But at the same time, I'm reminded of what Simon Sinek went viral for 10 years ago when he was having a real right old moan at millennials for how they're just kind of throwing their toys out the cot. So with that in mind, is there a sort of a, maybe back to that spectrum that you described, Jody, is there a sort of a sweet spot in being able to have enough of an awareness and a consciousness of how you're feeling, being able to check in, using the tools, understanding a practice, but then also, I don't know how else to say this, but not being a snowflake and being able to be resilient and being able to kind of muscle through certain things that sometimes you don't have the time or you don't have the resource to be able to do? Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is transactional analysis, really, which is being child, adult, or parent, or also the classic persecutor triangle, where you're victim, persecutor, or what's the third P? The other P? Always forget it. But yes, it's a balance and act, which is paying attention to our thoughts and emotions, but not, this is a very technical term, taking the piss, where we use it as an excuse, an excuse to disarm other people, an excuse to not allow certain conversations. And this is what, you know, the whole, my, I threw in earlier about my emotions are valid. And, you know, all of that, there is a, we have, you're right, we have, there's been a swinging in the other direction, or an abuse, really, of the topic. And so we need to course correct a little bit. And honestly, I think a massive part of that actually is about education. It is about understanding something as simple, emotional literacy. Like, most people will either be offended, which I don't believe is a thing, and I'm offended by people that are offended. Anger, like, when you look at Brené, it's done, it was 7,000 people or something, and the average amount of emotions that they can name and describe are 4, right? Now, that's America, but still, And so how can we understand ourselves if we don't have the language to understand ourselves, if we don't know that behind anger, there's usually, there's like upwards of like 27 other emotions. Anger is usually how it manifests, but behind it is shame, is disappointment, frustration, regret, all of these other things. But if you don't have this skill to become and know that it's a practice, an emotional detective, then you still work at face value. You think the thing is here when that's not the thing. The thing is always behind the thing you think it is. So, yeah.
It's not what it appears to be, I think is, a good way to see that and to stop yourself from that self-deception in a way as well. You know, am I really, pissed off about this, or is there something else that really needs my attention? And I think often we don't make that distinction in a meaningful way. A last bit of what I want to chat to you about, I'm loving this conversation and it feels like we can talk for hours, but until I get you back on here again, which hopefully doesn't take another couple of years, you were talking about tools. And, you go to the gym, you lift weights, you play football, you do things to help you to stretch and improve those physical muscles. So what are the mental muscles, and more importantly, what are some practical tools that anyone who's listening, that perhaps even you, put into regular use every day or every week or however often that needs to be, in order to just keep that baseline of fitness going?
There's so many different tools. I'll give you a super, 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 super simple one, which is actually just asking yourself on a scale of 0 to 10 how your day was, and marking that down and tracking that. And even, if it's an 8, what made it an 8? Well, actually, I got out with the dog, I had a good conversation with a friend, and I got some things done. And then, you're going to have 2s and 3s and 5s. And what are those? Because we rely too much on our memory. We go, I've been feeling terrible for months, and it's because of this, and it's because of that. And actually, again, gathering data on yourself and decoding what a good day looks like for you and what a bad day looks like for you, and then designing for that, right? I was just messaging you yesterday about some supplements, because I, like all great things in life, we do these good things and then we stop for no good reason. So I know that when I have the right supplements to support my health, when I kick off the day with a green smoothie, I know, I'm sorry, it's so cliche, but it's true. When I get the nutrients into my body, when I have had a walk, even just those three things are enough to nudge me up by 2 points, right? And feeling productive, a sense of progress always feels good as well. And some quality time with my kids, right? But it still acts like I don't know how to have a good day, and it's also random. And then when you know those things, you design for those things, and you start to see like the temptation when you're getting into a funk. Unfortunately, we've usually slipped down the slide before we realize we're down the slide. And then we're looking for that one thing that one person said, or that happened, or that was done, and it's that their fault. When actually, you have to always go back to the fundamentals. Are you getting sleep? Are you getting exercise? Are you eating the right foods? Once you can tick the box to all of those, then you can start to look to the external forces and go, okay, do I have too much on my plate? Am I overwhelmed? Is this person not good for my health? And so like the book is full of tools. The whole business that we run is about imparting these tools and practicing these tools. We have ones for limiting beliefs. We have ones for changing the narrative around your thinking patterns. We have ones for emotional regulation. Silent Scream is one that I love for getting out of anxiety when you're experiencing the amygdala hijack. It's something physiological that you can do. But just tracking your data and decoding, codifying what makes you know, an 8+ for you, and then designing for that to make sure that it's not accidental. That would be the simplest tool that I could give.
Mm. Wonderful. Yeah. The conscious designing of, I suppose it starts with being able to notice when things go right, when I feel better. Okay. What leads to those things? Great. Do more of that. Right? It's almost like a heuristic in a way. You kind of, okay, let's notch that up. Let's notch that down. That doesn't work for me. Yeah, wonderful. Well, I think what I've taken away, and perhaps the rest of the community today as well, is that, you know, it's like any kind of fitness, it's about the practice and about putting in the time and the noticing and the energy to seeing these things, what works, what doesn't. I suppose a dose of patience helps too. And then also just your helicopter analogy is still really strong in my mind about being able to have the choice to elevate your perspective, because we always do have that choice, right? The situation and the circumstances might not be, but our response and how we choose to take it forward is always a choice. It's always a set of options we have in front of us, right?
Exactly. And that's part of the secret to life, is recognizing that, and this is Viktor Frankl again, we can't control most of events in life. We can't control what happens, but we do have control over how we decide it's going to affect our life and what our emotional response to that is going to be. And it doesn't feel like we do. That's the problem. It's an illusion. And that's why we need to remind ourselves that we do. And the pause and the space helps with that. And then it's actually back to, it's experimenting. I'm going to experiment with not reacting with anger and raising my voice, because by the way, when there's a reaction, there's always, you trigger, right? You kind of create it, right? So I'm going to practice a different response and see what happens. And you will then get a different reaction, and it's usually a more positive one. So the benefit of this is it changes fundamentally the quality of your life. It changes fundamentally the quality of your life. If you are being responsive instead of reactive, there's a ripple effect. And so what things that would normally escalate, de-escalate. And so you have less of those outbursts. You have less of those bad behaviors or bad situations, because you can't control other people. You can control yourself, and that influences other people, usually for the positive.
Beautifully said. Wow. I feel like it's just been an education. I feel like my brain is just fitter after this conversation, and I'm sure everyone else feels that way too. Jodi, thank you. Thank you for your time today. Thanks for being generous and talking about what you're clearly amazing and passionate at. And I hope to have you on with us again soon. I see that Manette is going to make sure she buys your book. Awesome. Spreading the word. Thanks again. Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for listening to this episode of Humble Mind. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're curious to take a look at our community, if you're not a member, you're missing out. Make sure you head to humblemind.co to check out more and to see what we're up to. I look forward to seeing you there. Until next time.